Sometimes you choose courage, and at other times it's forced upon you. Courage Unraveled is a podcast series where you get to listen to insights, discussions, conversations, and stories from people from all walks of life. You'll be served with dollops of courage, resilience, and strength here. So come along and be educated and inspired. You just may find new ways to flex your own courage muscle. My name is Sana Turnock, and I'm your host. Have you ever wondered what it would be like to foster a child in the middle of nowhere? Jane Smith, not her real name, lives on a station somewhere in Australia on 1 million acres of land. I seriously cannot fathom that. Some time ago, Jane was studying to be a doctor. During her training, she did a few units on Indigenous affairs and thought that she had it all covered when she and her husband decided to adopt two Indigenous children. Little did she realise she was going to go on a rollercoaster ride that would involve intergenerational trauma and all the behaviours that came with it. Jane wants to share this story so that people will get a real insight into the joys and challenges of adoption. She shares her fears, being humbled, and the personal and spiritual growth she's experienced since adopting two Indigenous children. She also provides some insight into being a white woman who moves between a white world and Indigenous culture because she wants her adopted children to never forget their Indigenous heritage. I invite you to listen to Jane's experience. A couple of things. I would like to let you know that there are no Indigenous names mentioned in this story. And if you find this story triggering at any point, please stop listening and seek the advice of an appropriate health professional. It's a real privilege to be able to share these inspiring podcasts of courage with you. The work undertaken takes many hours to put together and is self-funded. Become a Courage Unraveled patron on Patreon, and not only will you be supporting the podcast, you will also be helping yourself by investing in your own courage. Get access to pre-release episodes and patron-only specials. It's easy being a patron, and the first tiers are less than 2 coffees per month. Cultivate and flex your courage muscle by signing up for a one-to-one Grow Into My Courage program and grab your very own journal. You grow your courage muscle by activating it. Listen to the podcasts, grab yourself the courage journal, sign up to the Grow Into My Courage program and become a patron. After this episode, head over to courageunraveled.com. It's all happening there. Grow into your courage today. Hello, Jane, and welcome to Courage Unraveled.
Oh, hi, Sana. It's so lovely to be here.
I know where you are in the world. It's very, very hot and balmy, yeah?
Yes, it's pretty muggy, to put it mildly. It's a sweltering outside at the moment. We're all completely saturated with sweat.
Oh, I'll try not to get you sitting in that seat for too long. Let's see how we go. You live in the rural part of Australia, and this could be described as being remote. What's everyday living like where you live? How close are your neighbours, for example?
We're on an agricultural property, and it's 1 and a bit million acres. Our closest neighbours are 40 kilometres away. They're amazing people, close enough to have a barbie every few weeks, which is great. We have 5 children and they do school of the year. We're in school holidays at the moment, so they're all being forced to do chores all morning. But normally they are in a little school room just like other kids, but we're around them all day, every day. They're a big part of our lives, and yeah.
There you go. You said 1 million acres. I still can't fathom 1 million acres.
It is, but it's very arid sort of country.
Describe the kind of community that you live in. You know, what kind of social issues does the community have to contend with because of its isolation?
Because of our isolation, I think we have a really strong knit, really small community just amongst all the other isolated people. Even the School of the Air community is very strong. We're not really a big part of the community because we go there once every few months. We get all of our groceries and everything on a mail truck once a week. So although we feel a little bit like we're part of that community, it's sort of like we're in two communities, really. We actually get all our groceries on a mail truck once a week. We're very, very lucky. The mail truck comes every week and brings our mail. So it's not
okay.
That bad.
Okay. Social issues for the community?
Social issues in our towns, which extends to the bush, are now horrendous. There's a fairly high Indigenous population in our local town as well, and they really struggle with, it's horrible to talk about even, but fairly stereotypical issues of being in the poverty cycle, the causes of which are very complex and intergenerational. There's a lot of domestic violence, a lot of violence full stop, a lot of neglect, and not many kids going to school. Those same problems that we see all over Australia.
Because you're in a very small and isolated community, it's probably accentuated, I imagine.
Yeah, you certainly see it a lot more. It's very visible. I guess in a bigger place like a city, it's probably harder to notice because if you live in a certain suburb, you don't really notice the people sitting around drinking at 10 o'clock in the morning and because you don't go to that suburb, you know. But in a smaller town, you see that it's a lot more visible.
Okay. Now that there's a sense of landscape and environment, I want to shift the conversation a bit. You've come onto Courage Unraveled to share your journey into fostering, specifically your experience of fostering two Indigenous children along with having your own three kids. Initially, you wanted to become a doctor, and in doing so, you studied a number of units on Indigenous health as this, you know, was the interest for you. So when you thought about fostering, you thought that you're all set, right? You knew what you could do and you knew what to do. What was the actual reality of the experience?
When I was studying medicine, I did every Aboriginal unit that they had at UWA in medicine, and I thought I had a pretty good grasp on it all. I had an understanding, probably better than most people. Certainly we were pretty well informed about the stolen generation and just everything, all the terrible things that happened that I think a lot of people didn't learn it at school, that's for sure. But I guess it's not until you are faced with it and are more personally involved in it, I guess, your children become a consequence of all the terrible issues that are going on in that community. They're very affected by it, and not just them, but their brothers and sisters and their nieces and nephews and their aunties and uncles, their whole family. I thought I had a really good grasp on it, and I didn't. It's impossible to learn about in a textbook, really. The depth of it. It seems so fixable or a bit easier to fix, I guess, when you're in a textbook setting. But the reality of it is just so complex, a lot more complex than I imagined.
Anything intergenerational is, isn't it? Like, yeah, it's part of the DNA. It's not just Indigenous cultures, but just generally when you're dealing with trauma or domestic violence. Absolutely. I've been talking to people who've had family members as prisoners and things like that. They carry that forward. So it's part of that human psyche that we carry through, or it can be.
I really underestimated that side of things and the spiritual side. Well, that's been a pleasant surprise of how strong there's a spiritual side that has certainly stayed with daughter. Our son's too young to work that out yet, but there's certainly a spiritual side that is definitely an epigenetic it's a genetic thing, you know. She's just got this amazing connection to country and to the earth and to all living things around her and non-living that we don't see other kids.
Beautiful. Hopefully she'll always have that. You mentioned the childhood and intergenerational trauma that's played a big role in the lives of your foster kids. Can you expand on that so we get a sense of insight and understanding into what they've gone through and how you and your husband have, you know, tried to navigate your way through this?
It has really been, holy moly, the biggest learning curve. So I feel so ignorant afterwards thinking I knew it all like I always do. We just signed up for foster care because we thought, you know, we're nice people, we're good, normal, fairly normal humans and we're middle class, we can afford to have another kid and it's the right thing to do without really understanding the effects of trauma on a child. Probably luckily at the time because otherwise we might not have done it. I hope we would have, but maybe we wouldn't have been courageous enough. But I'd like to point out at the end of the story, it's definitely worth it because it was the best thing we've ever done. But those first 3 years of having this little poppet sent our way when she was 2.5, she'd been out at a remote Aboriginal community. She was in such a mess. Her hair was falling out from fungal infections. She was so painfully skinny. She didn't speak at all. She'd just been looking after herself. She was fending for herself pretty much. 2.5 is still pretty malleable though. We loved her, looked after her, and, you know, she had a lot of temper tantrums, which I thought was just terrible twos, tantruming. Obviously, it was a lot deeper than that. She was with us for 3.5 months, and then they found a culturally appropriate placement for her, which was another Aboriginal family. So she was taken away, and she actually went through 5 different placements over the next 2.5 years, and I was absolutely heartbroken. I'd really committed to this little girl, and it was horrible. Then Christmas, a couple of years later, the day after Christmas, we always call her our Christmas present because the DCP rang up again. I was pregnant with number 3 at the time, and said, oh, how do you feel about having another child? And I said, oh, we're just about to have another baby. And she said who it was and went, oh, of course I had to say yes. So she's been with us ever since. However, when she came back at 5, there was just so much more trauma, I guess, that had gone on. So it was cumulative and it was really, really hard work. She had all of these issues that come along. We didn't even know what things would set her off, and she didn't. She was nonverbal at 5. She had dyspraxia, so her muscles weren't working between her tongue and her brain, but her nerves weren't working to her muscles in her tongue. So she was still nonverbal. We did full-on speech therapy and just learning to eat properly and move the food from the side of her mouth. She was pretty much wild still, wasn't toilet trained. She hadn't been in the shower probably since she was an ass, it felt like. The first shower I had with her was me holding her fully dressed in the shower, and then 5 days after that, she's happy as Larry, loves having a shower, and then took another few weeks to get her into the bath with that other daughter. And, you know, it just took a long time for this. But then there'd be these huge emotional outbursts and we couldn't work out what had triggered it. And she couldn't tell us because she didn't have words to say what it was. So she couldn't tell us what it was either when we'd calmed everything down. But she would have these massive flip-outs. She would smash everything on in the classroom, everything off every desk, rip everyone's work off the walls. And sometimes they went for an hour at a time. It was just all this terrible energy that just had to go somewhere that she didn't know where to put it. And we'd try and catch it. So by this stage, I was ringing the CAMS people thinking, oh, my God, this poor little brain is too broken for me to work with. I can't help her anymore. Finally, which I had done a lot earlier, talked to CAMS, the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Service in town. They were so instrumental into us getting a better grip on what was going on, that it wasn't just naughty behaviour either. It was genuine trauma that she just didn't know what to do with, these overwhelming feelings of being frightened or terrified or whatever. Well, we still don't know what it was. We never will. So it was very challenging because we'd think everything was going really well and then all of a sudden, oh my gosh, and if we went somewhere or we went on holidays, often I had to spend hours in the car with a little puppet flipping out in the car. And so it was fairly taxing on us as a couple and on our other kids as well. Often I'd just leave her alone as long as she's in a safe space, leave her to scream and do whatever she had to. But yeah, we didn't understand that. I thought she had something really wrong with her, but it was just post-traumatic trauma coming out. It actually took 3 years for her to be able to relax into a hug. Whenever you hugged her and I'd rock her and hold her, she'd be stiff as a board. She was unable to relax. You know, we all have our normal stress hormone throughout the day and that's what gets us out of bed in the morning. But her level was like a foot higher than the rest of us. She was just operating up there somewhere. Her stress hormones were so high, so it affected her sleep and everything.
It sounded like she was pretty much in survival mode all the time, hence, you know, the cortisol levels being constantly high.
Completely survival mode. It was really hard for her to learn new things. School was very difficult because she's sitting in the schoolroom just casing the joint for the nearest exit, watching any tiny change in your tone of voice or ready to bolt out of there. You know, she was hoarding food and all of those things that are typical of a child that has grown up with those sort of issues that we didn't understand until we'd started chatting to CAMS, and that really helped us empathise instead of getting cross. I feel so terrible. I used to get so cross and I try not to because I know being cross at someone who's cross is never going to help anything. But she just pressed every little button you have. And this sandcastle syndrome, I don't know if it's a real syndrome, I'm not sure. As soon as something was going really well, possibly be, this is too good, we'll have to wreck something, we'll have to smash something special of mum's, or no one could possibly love me, or it's not real. But, you know, persistence and the help of a lot of amazing people, man, she's come through the other side to be a really incredible human being. She's 15 this year and amazing. She's done some amazing things.
Brilliant. Who wouldn't go unscathed in that situation with self-worth issues and sabotage and all those things that they don't know that's what they're doing, but from what you've described, it sounds like that was probably innately part of who she was at that point in time. I think we all have it to a certain degree. Some have it more strongly than others.
It's really exacerbated in that setting, yeah.
You've described your experience to date as being humbling, terrifying, heartbreaking, as well as graceful. How has it humbled you?
It's made me realise how much I don't know and how much I have to learn. It's also humbled me in saying, God, how fortunate we are and how fortunate my parents were and my parents' parents and our whole family. Yeah, it's humbled me in so many ways. Also actually getting to know our daughter's family, who we probably know the best. I haven't unfortunately had as much contact with our son's family yet, but hopefully it will keep growing. But getting to know them and seeing how accepting they've been of us looking after their daughter and sister and auntie and niece has been really humbling, in that they treat us like family and they are beautiful to us and to our kids, and they're always welcoming. They always make us feel welcome, and they love our daughter just as much as they ever did, and that is really humbling. It's amazing.
What have been some things that you've actually just had to come to terms with that perhaps other parents don't have to even think about?
That's a complicated question. We don't have to befriend our kids' parents, but we really want her to grow up being a strong, proud Aboriginal woman. And we are not Aboriginal people. We understand that we can't raise her to her full potential by ourselves. So we encourage every bit of family and friend and mentor interaction that we can find. She's got a couple of pretty amazing Aboriginal women in her life, and some that are just family that love her that are terrifying to deal with. That's probably one of the hardest things, is seeing, oh, her sister, she's living with someone, you know, the father of her children had 3 children by 17, and she's often got a fat lip and just got no teeth left, and she's in a really, really bad place. She's a beautiful girl. She really is, but she's hard and tough and pretty scary just because she has to be. It's heartbreaking. That side of things is very hard for us as parents to explain to our daughter and for her to be able to come to terms with. And sometimes she feels angry and she doesn't want to see her sister because she's angry that she lets that happen. So we just have to talk through all of that. And she's got an amazing understanding now, which is where the grace part comes in. I think it's so hard to come to terms with these 2 different lives, you know, these 2 different worlds, and they are so different. One is really pretty scary and ours is pretty constant and stable, a little bit crazy, but never scary. She's just somehow managed to accept the things she cannot change, as the famous prayer goes, and she's not in a position yet to change the things that she can, but I'm confident that she will as she grows up. But seeing that side of her has been really beautiful.
Sounds like she's really starting to gain her own wisdom.
Oh, she really is, you know. This is so corny, but can I just read you a poem? She actually wrote this poem when she was 9 years old. This is "The Life in My Heart. As I slowly grow, there's a lot I need to know. As the wind blows and the rain goes, the lightning flashes and the fire dashes. The wolves are fighting. I know I'm just young, but I still know it's fun. I know the life that is going to be the best that you'll see." Isn't that amazing? The story about which wolf you feed wins, we use that a lot, talking to her about her emotions. I actually wrote a response. This is a show about courage, so I'm going to read my poem, the one and only poem I've ever written in my life, at 1 o'clock in the morning after she wrote this poem. My response was, "I think I have a shining star in my hands. At first she burnt me, for I did not know how to hold her, but I am learning how to let her shine, and now I am humbled by her grace and glow in her light."
That is really beautiful. Let's keep going. How has fostering Indigenous children and all that you've learnt so far influenced the parenting style of your biological kids? What are they learning from the experience as well? So I guess there are 2 questions in this.
I'm so proud of them all in a lot of respects. When we go to some places, it's a bit scary. And when we're going to visit someone in the scarier parts of town that probably you don't go to normally after 3:30, 4 o'clock, they see where other kids have come from, I guess. They don't really have to talk about it much. They just sort of know how lucky they are. They're not judgmental or standoffish. They've also had some insight into some really amazing, and I don't even know what words to use for it, but I guess some spiritual things that have happened. I'm not particularly spiritual, but sort of heading that way. We have other kids out on respite over the holidays, for example. One of the most poignant things was after daughter's mother, biological mum, passed away last year, which was very sad. some local elder had told us that ibis out here where we are, and they were hit, the old people, it's actually from a different language group. We never see ibis out here, but when we do, we just see three or four, and it's always around our daughter's birthday. So we've just always gone with that. Then the most amazing thing happened, and I don't even know if it is in her particular mob, but we had the school holidays, we had a bunch of other kids out on respite, all these other Aboriginal kids on the holidays, and her mum's funeral was being held the week after the holidays when we went back in. So I was just out there with all these kids, and there was this amazing sound. There were kids covered in mud and playing monsters, and they're all venturing out at this beautiful lake that we've got here that just had a skim of water on it. It was a big island in the middle. And heard this sound, and we looked up, and there was this huge flock of ibis. There would have been about 100 ibis. It was unbelievable. And they were just circling. We've never, ever seen anything like it before or since. My husband's family's never seen anything like it. Anyway, circling around and around and around. The kids were all just staring up at the sky, awestruck. And then they just landed in the middle of the lake. And at the very front was one ibis that was back to front. She was white where she should have been black and black where she should have been white. And our daughter's mum was just always a bit different. I think she was actually just a really, really sensitive human being, now that I know her daughter so much better, because our daughter's very sensitive, and I just don't think she tolerated the harshness of her reality. She just never quite fitted in. It really felt like that was mum, you know. It was amazing. It was so amazing. We were all speechless for ages, but all of our kids knew. They just felt like, oh, this is the old people, and we've never seen so many, and they're here because you guys are all here. And our kids got to witness it, and they were all kids in care. They weren't with their mums and dads, but they were so special because all their old people had come to see them at this lake. Maybe that is manifesting to the universe. I don't care what you call it, but it was a really spiritual thing, and it was incredible. So I think they have the luxury of having Indigenous brothers and sisters as well.
Yeah, that's beautiful. What a beautiful symbolic story that you shared.
It was incredible, yeah.
What's it like navigating the system of fostering where you live?
It's probably a lot easier being out here because they are so desperate for carers in our local town, so desperate. There's just not enough. They literally now, they only take children into care that they think will die if they don't remove them from care, because there's just nowhere to put them. There are no foster carers. No one wants to look after all these kids. They're hard work, you know, that's why I understand that. And the poverty cycle for the people that are in it is getting harder to get out of. The wealth gap is just getting bigger and bigger. It's so hard to get out of that cycle of never having had anyone in your life that's worked or had a job. Makes it very hard, or finished primary school. Basically, we just went in for a couple of interviews, filled out a lot of paperwork. I had working with children checks and all of that kind of stuff, which is no biggie, and then went from there. But I think in the city, it's probably a little bit more rigorous, maybe. I don't want to imply that the country system's no good and they don't really care where they send their kids, but I guess we've ticked all the boxes and continue to, so we find it very easy now. We just have an interview once a year. They come to us, you know, it's no big deal. They drive out here. It's brilliant now. That first time was very hard, and I certainly know of other people who've had a much harder time retaining contact with children that have gone back to their biological parents, and that's been very hard for them. I don't feel that they've had a lot of support, but I guess that is the courageous thing of giving your heart to someone, being vulnerable to a child, allowing yourself to love and care for a little person that may not always be there in the long term. We sort of know here that they will be in the long term because there's no other carers here. The few families that do care are all getting older, as are we. We're happy to do respite from now on, be an auntie and uncle to many children. That's enough for me.
How important do you think it is to have an understanding and observance of the cultural protocol when fostering or adopting an Indigenous child, as there are many Indigenous cultural groups within Australia, right? So they're not the same. Do you think that's an important thing to do?
Absolutely. But I know that it's hard. I know it's quite intimidating. I guess I've just been lucky in that I happened to look after eldest daughter's sister once when she was a teenager. She didn't even speak to me, really, didn't want a bar of me. Of course, she was a teenager, but opened a window where I've always had a rapport with her that has grown, especially once she started having her own babies. Every time we did go to town, I'd have some baby hand-me-downs clothes or pot roast, some kangaroo tails or something to try and help nurture her a little bit, because she had no one to nurture her. So we built up enough of a relationship for her to include us. I wasn't really ready to let our daughter go by herself into that community again. I have since, at her mum's passing away. It was easy because I had a connection that I've been able to build upon, and now pretty much everyone knows us in town, I think, or they all know our car. And I've capitalised on that. I always buy them a cook chook and a packet of icy poles or something when I'm coming out, and they come and help me unload the groceries. So we've managed to have a good rapport. And actually, even people I haven't known very well that I've happened to have met, and sometimes they're quite intimidating, but I've just been really honest and open and frank and said, you know, I know this is a weird thing to say, but I know I'm a white person and I really want our daughter to have a good cultural understanding of her culture and her spirituality. And they've always been open arms. I've never had a negative experience ever. And I've approached some pretty, what I thought were scary people, but they've always been really kind and generous with their knowledge, not necessarily with me, but certainly with our daughter.
Maybe that's it. I mean, you're having the courage to actually go up to these people and just open yourself up to being vulnerable, because that's what you're doing,
for
the sake of your daughter.
Appreciate that they know that's not an easy thing for me to say. They're all beautiful people. It's just the drugs and the alcohol that messes everything up and makes people not as beautiful as they normally would be.
What advice would you give anyone considering fostering Indigenous children within Australia?
I'm a huge advocate for fostering not just Indigenous, any child, you know, that needs help, that is not safe in their own home or not being looked after well. I'd have to say it has been the most rewarding, one of the hardest things I think you can do, but parenting is one of the hardest things you can do. You know, as soon as you've got more than one child, how different even genetic siblings can be. They are so different and different at different stages, and so many issues that go on, and it doesn't get easier as they get older. It gets more complicated, a lot more counselling going on, but I would highly recommend it. It is such a rewarding, it's almost a selfish thing to do in that it fills me with so much love and joy when I'm having a group cuddle in bed with my 5 bambinos, and I just love them all so much. You don't automatically love another child. It takes a long time for, you know, you care about them and want the best for them, but you don't just fall in love with them. But wow, once you do, it is, and they love you just as much. They would do anything for you, like children do for their parents. They know that I'm never their biological parents. We're clear about that. They have two families, and everyone has enough love in their heart for two families. They love us just as much as they love their biological families. It's a wonderful and enriching experience for us and for our children. And I'd say even for our family and friends. I think even our family and friends really love all of our kids, and it's beautiful for the whole community really to be part of, for our kids to feel like this beautiful community that we have out here, our little bush community, and then our family community of all our extended family that are down in the city. So yeah, I would highly recommend anyone that's thinking about fostering to definitely be brave, go in there and put your name down. Respite is a good place to start to see if it's something you think you could do in the long term.
You've shared some poignant everyday moments of courage in your notes to me. One of them is that courage is just being kind sometimes, even when it feels a little scary.
Do you know, I was just thinking about that just before we had the interview. I was driving down a particular street and I ran over a dog when I was in our local town, which was horrible. It ran straight under my wheels, and I actually was going really slowly. I'd had a bit of a joke with these two boys on bikes in front of me that should have been at school. So I had my window down and I'd made a bit of a joke about beating them to the end. I was sitting at about 40 km and this dog ran straight under my front tyre, and then I ran over it again with the back tyre. Oh, it was horrible. I turned around, stopped the car, turned around, and I hadn't noticed because I'd been looking at the road and at the boys ahead of me on the road. So I hadn't been looking at the house, but it happened right outside a house. It was about 10:30 in the morning, and right outside a house where there were a lot of Indigenous people all drinking, and they were really cross. They were older people, and oh my gosh, as I got out of the car, I realised a man had already picked the dog up and was weeping, crying over the dog, and they were yelling lots of really bad things I'd never been called before in my life. It was starting to get quite scary, and I must admit, for a minute I thought, oh my God, I'm going to jump back in the car and run and just hightail it out of here. But I couldn't. This poor man and his dog, it wasn't actually even his dog, it was the woman's dog down the road. I went up and I said, I'm so, so sorry, and they're still yelling right in my face. One lady in particular, she was really drunk, she had a wonky eye, she was really scary, she looked really mad, and I was actually being mindful of where I was in relation to her. I thought she might hit me or something because she was yelling at me a lot. They took me over to the owner's house, who was over the road, and I said, I'm so, so sorry, but I just ran over your dog. Would you like me to bury him in your backyard for you? And she said, oh, no, just take it away. She didn't really mind so much. But it was all these other people that were so mad and so angry, and I just was dawning on me as it was unfolding that they were just mad at so much else. There's so many other things, and so sad about so many other things. And here's this white fella in a big four-wheel drive just came down and smashed one of their dogs right in front of them. You know, just all these other things that they were actually mad and sad about. The owner of the Dogger's sympathy card and actually a bunch of lilies from Woolies. I was pretty nervous about that whole thing, but it turned out to be the best thing ever, because actually the lady who was really in my face and the most angry turned out to be his youngest son's grandma. And I'd since seen her a couple of times. This only happened this year, but I hadn't seen her enough to remember who's who. So many people. I'm terrible with faces. One of her other granddaughters introduced us, and we just had a bit of a laugh and a joke about it, and she was eating a bit of humble pie. But I made it completely okay. And then I was talking to one of the people living on the street who I was due to go and visit, and said, oh, geez, oh, I'm too scared to take our car down that street. We're in big strife there. I just hit one of the puppy dogs. And I said, oh, no, don't worry. Everyone knows who it is. It's okay. We heard about the flowers. You're okay. Don't worry about it. Safe as houses. So actually doing something really scary, but doing it with the best intention, you know, even though it felt a little bit threatening at the time, turned out for the best.
It sounds like it. Good on you. The other thing that you mentioned in your notes was that you said that courage is getting out of bed sometimes when you have another Groundhog Day in front of you, and that you were sick to death of thinking for all the people in your family. So when you have those thoughts, what kind of support do you have to keep yourself resilient and moving forward?
A healthy smoothie. Anyone with kids knows, and probably anyone, you know, we all have days where we just, oh God, not again. And you just have to lie there just for a little bit and just listen to the kids, even sometimes when they're arguing, but it's kind of funny. And you just have to soldier on and get one foot in front of the other, don't you? I suppose my supports would be my sister. I offload and whinge to her a lot, and my neighbour. I offload a lot to her as well. She's gorgeous.
I'm glad you've got someone who's, although 40 kilometres away, they're still your neighbour.
Oh, they're only a phone call though.
So what do you define as courage?
Like I've heard you say on your podcast that it is, you're so right, it is such a subjective and relative thing, isn't it? But I guess that it is really just doing something that is hard, that might seem hard to you either physically or emotionally, but giving it your best shot. And if you fail, you fail, but just giving it a go. And I know it's so hard for some people to get up and talk in front of people or to go to university or to get out of bed in the morning some days, you know, there's speaking about relativity and what mood you're in and how the day's been going. And as you say, sometimes it's forced upon you with illness or loss. Courage, it's just doing something when it's not necessarily the easiest path or the easiest thing to do.
Are you courageous?
Mildly, probably a bit more ignorant and naive than courageous and impulsive. Sometimes I do things and go, oh, God, what have I done? I had this discussion with someone over a few drinks a little while ago, and I think we can all safely say that we're all courageous. I think everyone's courageous in one way or another.
Absolutely. I love your honesty today. I love your passion and the passion that you have to want to give to others. Thank you very much for being on Courage Unraveled today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks so much, Sana. I think you do a wonderful job.
I hope you found this to be a worthwhile conversation. Intergenerational trauma is not to be underestimated, whether it be within an Indigenous culture or any other culture for that matter. It can be debilitating and disruptive. It causes dysfunction and can destroy families and ethnic groups world over. It's not easy walking between two cultures, but it sounds like Jane's daughter is finding her way. I see her walking with grace, her head held high. If you found any of this story triggering, as mentioned earlier, please contact an appropriate health professional. This is Series 5, Episode 26. Thank you so much for listening to Courage Unraveled. If you like what you hear, subscribe via your favourite listening platform. Jump over to courageunraveled.com where you can find the podcasts, Courage Journal, and Courage Mindset coaching programs I offer. If you're looking for a keynote speaker on the topic of courage, send me an email via the website. I'm Sana Turnock, your Courage Unraveled host. Until next time.